This is Brian Taylor, and this is number 7 in a series of 7 talks for the course The Empty Way, Zen Buddhism and Contemplative Christianity. This week in the course, I have invited you to access some excellent resources on this week's subject of compassion about Christian contemplative and Buddhist approaches to service and social justice. The links for all of these are found on this page for this week on the Moodle site. The first of these resources is a YouTube audio of a guided meditation on metta, or loving kindness, by Sharon Salzberg, a Buddhist teacher at the Insight Meditation Society. She offers a practice of meditation and guides you into that meditation that cultivates a kind heart towards other people, even for those with whom we are in conflict. That's a metta loving kindness meditation. The second is a copy of the Metta Sutra itself, which is an ancient Buddhist sutra or set of verses on loving kindness upon which Salzberg's meditation is based. And the third posting is a short article by Sung Taek Cho on Buddhist concepts of selflessness and interdependence as a foundation for social justice. So we begin with Robert Kennedy's chapter 9 on no self in his book Zen Gifts to Christians. In this chapter, the ox herder in the ox herding series returns to his origin, and there's a transformation of the self into the absolute. Kennedy writes a bit about enlightenment, awakening to the true nature of reality. Enlightenment is, of course, important in Zen, and that can come in either dramatic or in gradual ways. But I think it's important to unpack what we mean by this term, enlightenment. For some of us, we may think of it as awakening to the wonder of the world in present moment awareness. This is what probably most people think of when they think of enlightenment. But enlightenment is also awakening to the essential emptiness of the self, the emptiness of reality, the ever-flowing impermanence of it all, and knowing that in one's being, and feeling it and seeing it, not just as a concept, that all beings and the self and the natural world are arising interdependently into being and they change along the way. This concept called emptiness is something that becomes incorporated in a person's life in terms of their everyday awareness when we say they are awakened. Now, the assumption of enlightenment for some people is that that it happens once and for all, and that one is somehow almost perfected and living in this perpetual state of bliss. And enlightened teachers are then revered as almost superhuman. And I think that this image of enlightenment has actually done a lot of damage. Because awakening may be firmly planted, fully realized, and the freedom of this awakening may be known experientially. A person may have realized their Buddha nature, realized in the sense of made real. But the experience of that can come and go. One is not just walking around in a constant state of concentration and bliss at the same time, all the time. And the experience of that doesn't guarantee that you're always consistently a loving or ethical person. Awakening is something that one grows into, and there is in the Buddhist tradition this idea of awakening after awakening. That is, one needs to continue to practice and to bring to awareness new experiences, new circumstances, new dimensions of reality in the self that become apparent only over time. And so there's awakening after awakening. Now, with this understanding, a Buddhist term of enlightenment comes closer to the Christian concept of contemplative transformation. Kennedy has some wonderful theology about contemplative transformation on page 110. In this chapter. And he talks about it in terms of union with God, which is, of course, is seen as the classic goal of contemplative prayer, is union with God. And Kennedy speaks about it in terms of dying to self and becoming Christ and union with God in Christ in the Eucharist as a physical spiritual experience. So in both traditions, whether we're speaking about enlightenment or union with God, it is not attained or given solely for one's personal happiness or healing alone. This is clear in both traditions, that awakening or union with God is attained or given precisely in order to be of better service to a suffering world. And so in chapter 10, Kennedy ends the book with the subject of compassionate service. In the final Oxfording picture, after enlightenment, the herder enters the market with open hands to serve. This is at the heart of the most basic Buddhist teaching, which is the Four Noble Truths. It has to do with the alleviation of suffering, the alleviation of all suffering, not just our own. Life is filled with suffering, the First Noble Truth says, and it goes on to say, there is a cause for that suffering. Thirdly, there is a cure for that suffering. And fourthly, that cure is the Eightfold Path. And because we are all interconnected and interdependent, because we are all one, the awakening that comes from or enables freedom from suffering is something that is not just a private matter. Our awakening from suffering is connected to alleviating the suffering of all other people. There's a term in Buddhism which is the bodhisattva. It can mean various things, but most broadly, a bodhisattva is a Buddhist who vows to do this, to alleviate the suffering of other people. The primary bodhisattva vow includes this saying, "Beings are numberless. I vow to save them." The vow is to alleviate suffering. That's the whole point of the Noble Truths, the whole point of the Dharma and practice, to alleviate our own and the world's suffering. Now, there are, of course, many motivations for Christian service and justice and for alleviating the suffering of others. One of them, we say, is because God loves us, so are we to love one another. We see that in the first letter of John and elsewhere. The Christian motivation for service and justice can come also from a place of inner transformation. And this is very similar to the Buddhist motivation. We are in unity with our brother or sister. We see Christ in not only ourselves, but in others. And so we naturally want to serve and help because we are our brother or sister. This is the great insight, of course, of St. Francis of Assisi, one of the icons of Christian compassion, especially in that story where he embraces the leper. Because he recognizes that he is at one with this brother of his. This latter motivation, coming from a place of inner transformation, where we see ourselves as one with God and other people, is probably one that is more naturally contemplative in terms of a motivation to serve. When we serve other people, especially from a contemplative foundation, we're not doing so as the privileged one who is stooping down to help the unfortunate other. This kind of charity only reinforces our ego. It reinforces a kind of dualism of above and below. Here I am who have so much, and I feel so good when I give to you who have so little. We see this a lot in charity and charitable kind of marketing, but rather we are serving God in the other because we are one, because we are equal, because we are all brothers and sisters. And so now I'd like to distinguish between two terms that are sometimes used interchangeably that I think it's important to keep in mind as we talk about compassion and living out our faith and our contemplative awareness in the world. And those two terms are service and social justice. So Service is can be Christian, it can be Buddhist, it can be secular, it can be anything. But in the Christian and Buddhist sense, service is often expressed in pastoral care. There are Buddhist chaplains, especially in hospices and jails and hospitals. Christian or Buddhist service can find expression in terms of feeding the hungry, disaster relief, NGOs that provide health care or water. It's direct aid to people who are in need. It's the classic story of Jesus talking about the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, of seeing Christ in those who are hungry and naked and thirsty, and responding to their direct need with love and compassion. Now, service is in some ways, I don't want to say easier, but it seems more accessible to more people than the other term, which is social justice. And this has to do with engagement with economic, socio-political policies, dealing with these big issues like poverty in a city, climate change, racism, war, nonviolence, to affect change through social justice is on a different level in terms of scope than direct service is. Both service and social justice are needed, and both of them call upon different gifts, and different people are called to either service or social justice in differing amounts. But in either case, the question for us in this course becomes, really because it's focused on individual practice, how does the individual practice of contemplation or meditation make one more compassionate and likely to give of oneself through service or social justice? Well, one of the ways that meditation works in this regard is that everything that is in the way of our natural capacity to love and to have compassion becomes revealed in meditation. Everything that stands in the way of our naturally inherent, divine, God-given ability to love and to serve is revealed as we sit in silence. Those resistances, those walls that we form between ourselves and other people, that kind of dualism that we create to keep ourselves above or different from the other, all of those things are revealed, and they are emptied out over time by God's grace. As mentioned earlier, our growth in whatever virtue we're talking about, let's say compassion here, our growth in that is a process of subtraction, not addition. We're not, as a contemplative, trying to make ourselves a more compassionate person. We're subtracting the accrued and conditioned tendencies that we have that stand in way of the natural compassion of God rising up through us. It's a process of subtraction, not addition. Through meditation, we bring self-awareness to our attachments, our aversions, our self-protection, our desire for control, our ego, so that as they get out of the way, God's own compassion can arise within us naturally. Now, there's another way in which meditation makes one more compassionate, I believe, whether it's expressed then in service or justice, and that is a psychological effect. Because in meditation, we can't help but see very clearly over time our own pain, our own inability to be in control. I mean, I've been meditating for decades, and I can't make myself sit in perfect silence with no thoughts. I'm not in control of my own brain. I'm not in control of my feelings. I'm not in control of my moods. I'm not in control of sometimes how I react to circumstances or other people. Self-awareness through contemplation is incredibly humbling. We see ourselves as we are, and the only thing we can do about that in contemplation is observe it and admit it and feel it and be present in it. That in itself is huge, by the way, and it's extremely healing, but it doesn't make it go away. And so we discover in meditation our own lack of control. We also discover our own pain that lies beneath the surface. Whatever's there in the way of pain, whether it's a feeling of alienation or grief or sadness, depression, whatever it is that may be underneath the surface in the form of pain in our lives, will come to the surface if we sit still. And if we are just present, it will rise to the surface as a feeling, as thoughts, as all sorts of sensations, maybe physical sensations. And so we become self-aware of pain, as well as our lack of control in life. Now this has a tremendous effect in terms of empathy, cultivating empathy. Instead of trying to be more empathetic towards other people, we discover that we are more empathetic towards other people the more we are in touch with our own pain and lack of control. Because we see other people that perhaps before we might have dismissed as, you know, that person's really out of control, or that person really is very reactive, or gosh, that person's so depressed, I really don't want to be around them. We see those attitudes being unraveled, so that over time we know that we share what they are experiencing and we have more empathy for them. And that translates to service, I think, in terms of sometimes just feeding the hungry or having some empathy for people who are in circumstances that might be very different from ours. Say they're living in poverty and we're not. But we are able to empathize. A relative of mine recently went through an experience like this. He was kind of inexplicably, from a medical standpoint, stricken with laryngitis, and he was unable to speak, and it became a chronic condition. He was unable to speak for 9 months. And this is a very verbal person who happens to also be very opinionated about other people and holding a lot of the judgments that I mentioned a minute ago about other people. And the experience of just not being able to speak was profound for him. He's a person of faith, and it brought him to his knees. It humbled him. He could no longer use words, which were his chief means of not only communication, but building up the self and defending against circumstances and sometimes other people. And he was vulnerable in a way that he had never been vulnerable. And he began to look at the vulnerability of other people very differently. And one time I asked him after it was over, how did this experience affect you? And he said, well, it changed me, he said. I have a lot more patience with other people, and I'm much less likely to judge them. And so, as I said, this can lead directly to service and to social justice, acts of social justice. And that's because meditation and contemplative prayer are powerful tools. They not only help us with our own problems of anxiety, stress, grief, and other suffering, but they open us up so that we can be in a better position to help alleviate the suffering of others. Again, I encourage you to take the time and listen and meditate with Sharon Salzberg's guidance on the Metta meditation, because it's really directly, it's a direct practice of what I'm talking about here. And also take a look at the Metta Sutra and the article on the Buddhist approach to social justice. I want to close this audio and this course by reading the Metta Sutta itself. As I said, I posted it on the Moodle site for this week, so you can have a copy for yourself. A sutta, or sutra, is a Hindu or Buddhist set of verses that is similar in form and use to the Jewish or Christian canticles that Episcopalians find in the Book of Common Prayer, or a psalm even. Tradition attributes the Metta Sutta to the Buddha himself. It is certainly of a very early Buddhist composition, and it has been in continual use for at least 2,000 years. The Metta Sutta is one of the most widely sutras used today, chanted or spoken by a wide variety of Buddhist groups in their devotional services. And again, metta means loving kindness, and so these are verses on loving kindness, or Metta Sutta. This is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches. Let one's senses be controlled. Let one be wise, but not puffed up. And let one not desire great possessions, even for one's family. Let one do nothing that is mean, or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. All living beings, whether weak or strong, in high or middle or low realms of existence, small or great, visible or invisible, near or far, born or to be born, may all beings be happy. Let no one deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. Even as a mother, at the risk of her life, watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and around, all without limit. So let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world, standing or walking, sitting or lying down. During all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude. Not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from sense appetites, one who achieves the way will be freed from the duality of birth and death.